Hello, listeners. Welcome to the third episode of Between Class. This month, we're talking about the true cost of college. We're lucky to have the student body president of Purdue University, Asada Gilmore, moderate this panel. Welcome, Asada.
Hi, Vahini. Thank you so much for having me. Hello, everyone. My name is Asada Gilmore. I have the honor and privilege of serving as a student body president at Purdue University for the 2020-2021 school year, and I'm so excited to chat today with Aiden Sova. Do you want to introduce yourself, Aiden?
Yeah, absolutely. My name is Aiden Sova. I'm a senior at the University of Michigan, and I am proud to say I'm a student government retiree and veteran, I like to say. I was previously the executive director of the Association of Big Ten Students, ABTS, where you're listening to, associate director the year before that, and I was on the steering committee and finance committee for the Associated Students of Michigan State University before I transferred over to the University of Michigan, where I was on their central student government. So a whole, you know, just host of words just to say that I'm a huge student government guy.
Yes, and our second panelist today, Rodrigo Tojo Garcia. Can you introduce yourself, Rodrigo?
Sure, thanks, Asada. My name is Rodrigo Tojo Garcia. I use pronouns like he and him. I'm a third year student at the University of Minnesota, and I study political science and Arabic. I've been involved in student government for the past 2 years now, and I am particularly focused on student research protections and affordability. In my capacity as a student representative to the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota, I work regularly with John Harandi, who was just on this show a short while ago. And in my spare time, I enjoy making kombucha and playing the piano.
Yes, I love kombucha and piano. And Rodrigo, you made me remember my pronouns, she and her. It's so important for accountability, so I really appreciate that. Now that we're in it, let's get started. And so today we're talking about college affordability. And we know that that covers various aspects of life. And so I guess our first question is going to be, what does college affordability mean to you? And what does that look like on your campuses?
Definitely. So for me, college affordability looks like, can the student whose family makes $30,000, $40,000 a year live comfortably and have the means to succeed in an academic setting just as much as his peer who may be making, you know, their family may be making, you know, six figures. At the University of Michigan in particular, we have a absolutely monstrous wealth gap. It's something like, I think like 70%, you know, like so many students at the University of Michigan are inordinately wealthy. I know that myself, as you know, raised in a low-income household, and you know, transferring over to the University of Michigan, it was very difficult to see people walking around with jackets that cost like 3 months' rent. You know, those Canada Gooses. And additionally too, Ann Arbor does not have any grocery store even close within accessibility. So you have all of these students, you know, in this food desert ordering food and, you know, taking Ubers everywhere. And which work for the low-income student is just frankly not accessible. So for, you know, the five some, and I'm being hyperbolic there when I say five, but for the group of, you know, low-income students at the University of Michigan, it is seemingly very difficult in order to, you know, just, you know, survive there academically.
Absolutely. Rodrigo, how about you?
Yeah, I think as Aiden was getting at, affordability is just as much a problem of accessibility when it comes to higher education as a lot of other factors. Truly, income inequality continues to be a problem all over the country, and it poses serious challenges, especially when we look at the way that race in particular intersects with income inequality in the United States. But to get at your question, I think when we're talking about affordability, especially in the context of the University of Minnesota, I also would like to see a future where income and the cost of just attendance are not barriers to students who want to attend the University of Minnesota, or for that matter, any higher education institution, and really achieve their goals in terms of higher education. And when I talk about that, one of the things that most stands out to me is the cost of living, which is particularly high in larger cities where many of our universities tend to be. And so that ends up piling up on things like rent, and as Aiden was saying, groceries, especially since, you know, the University of Minnesota is located in a food desert in within the Minneapolis-St. Paul Twin Cities metropolitan area. And so all of these factors are things that we need to consider when we're addressing affordability.
Absolutely. I'm going to kind of veer off the path here because you both mentioned food insecurity and having campuses that are located in food deserts. And Purdue is also a food desert, even though it was pretty big. We got a Target on campus, but with the items listed, it doesn't qualify as like a food source. It's more like a CVS. And so what have you been doing to advocate for affordable food services on your campus to ensure that students, low income, like you said, and all students have access to affordable food?
So at the University of Michigan, it's all essentially boils down to conversations with administration. And in terms of my sophomore year at the University of Michigan, my entire project was just working to get these combo lunch items similar to what Michigan State University has. At Michigan State, in addition to your meal plan, I believe this is just in the most basic of packages. When you are on campus, you can get a to-go meal from, you know, Michigan State's equivalent of like a CVS or something like that. They call them Sparties for free every single day, I think, with the exception of like Sundays or something, or 6 days a week. And that would be so unbelievably helpful if at the University of Michigan, students could also do that, because, you know, the dining halls are only open for so long. So it's 12 at night, you've been studying all day, you have no access, you're forced to eat out in a sense, or at least spend an inordinate amount of money just, you know, hoarding, you know, that food. And so all of my conversations with the administration were not at all fruitful. I essentially presented the model of Michigan State University and said, this works here, and it also is unbelievably beneficial to students. Like, why aren't we doing this? And essentially, it was a lot of talk around of we're in a fixed contract, it would be difficult to do. Initially, it would be very expensive to do. And I think that it just, unfortunately, always results in the conversation of, you know, the dollars and cents. But I think that that's, to answer your question, that advocacy really comes from speaking to the administration. And using your position in student government as well as a way to easily segue into those, because I know that a lot of administrations don't have their door open all the time for, you know, the student who may not be participating in these activities.
Yeah, at the University of Minnesota, we are also very much involved in trying to get a better sort of situation in terms of food and groceries on our campus. And so one of the ways that we're moving that forward is the establishment of our basic needs task force relatively recently. And as their name implies, they're sort of all about the basic needs of students. So whether that is finding housing, where they're gonna eat, all of these basic needs are covered under their purview. But that being said, we also have some other initiatives. I know, for example, that University of Minnesota students are highly involved in their off-campus communities. So, you know, a lot of the factors that produce these food deserts come about through, you know, strange zoning requirements or regulations. And so in Marcy Homes and in Dinkytown, students are very active in pushing for zoning in those areas to include spaces for groceries and food in general. And so, for example, we have a new apartment building that's going to be constructed just off of campus. And I know that students were very involved in pushing for there to be a space on the first floor of that building that would be dedicated to, that would have potentially space for a grocery store. And in addition, students are also involved at the administrative level in pushing to make sure that the resources that we have in place can be used to get students to where there is food. So one of the ways that that's been done is in the past advocating for the expansion of a zone pass, which is a free student pass that allows students to effectively ride the light rail for free within the University of Minnesota campus. Now, the problem with that as it stands is that, you know, there, since the University of Minnesota is a food desert, you need to go at least one stop off campus in either direction before you can actually walk to a grocery store relatively quickly. And so students have been very vocal about asking administration to look into further partnerships with the city of Minneapolis, and St. Paul would be involved as well, in either making the Zone Pass available for the entire Twin Cities Metro Transit light rail system, or alternatively expanding it in particular towards Prospect Park, which is where there is a grocery store just off of the light rail, which is also located at a location where there is a lot of student housing as well.
Those sound like great initiatives, and you're going to have to keep us updated. That's incredible work, and the Basic Needs Task Force as well. Here at Purdue, we're trying to explore options. Specifically this year, they required that even off-campus students had access to a dining hall package, but then all residents that live on campus are required to have a dining hall package, and the lowest still being quite expensive. At your universities, are on-campus residents required to have food packages, and does that augment the price it is to live?
To my knowledge, I don't believe so at the University of Michigan. However, it is so unbelievably expensive. If you tally up, you know, the amount of money one meal costs when you divvy that lump sum up each semester, it's just unbelievable. And I do know that there is some leeway in terms of there are multiple kinds of packages between the basic and, you know, the premium and the whatever. However, even the most basic of packages is just unbelievably expensive.
Yeah, the situation is quite similar at the University of Minnesota. As I understand it, all students who are assigned to residence halls at the University of Minnesota are required to have a meal plan of some sort. And those meal plans range in price, obviously, but if I recall correctly, I don't think there's a single one of them that's less than $1,000. And in fact, many of them are significantly more expensive than that.
Yeah, so it seems like we're all pretty much in the same boat there. So to go kind of before you get to campus, before you're even a student, there are a lot of costs associated with college, and whether that be paying to take a standardized test, SAT, ACT, the fee associated with applying to university, and in most cases, it's many universities, or even traveling to campus to do an on-campus visit. And so we already see in the pre-college phase where fates are being decided, and more often than not, low-income students don't have access to these same resources. Are your SGAs or even institutions at large spearheading any initiatives to make this process easier for students, whether that looks like waiving SAT, ACT requirement, or if there are scholarships that help pay for the costs associated with applying to college?
So specifically for the University of Michigan, I can't speak for any other district besides my own in terms of high school and, you know, the relationship with the school. But I do know that when I was applying to colleges, I just told my principal, she was just like, yeah, we'll call the university. They did cover it, thankfully. And in terms of, you know, student government associations, I'm, as of right now, unaware of any initiative like that. As I can say, I'm a proud student government retiree. But I can speak on, you know, those hidden costs associated with applying to colleges as well as, you know, getting to college. For every single student, you walk into a dorm room that's empty. And for low-income students, that's particularly devastating. The cost of sheets, the cost of a chair for your room, even to get a computer in there, to have this and that. Things that you would never think of. Like, there are people who have to buy their entire toiletry kit associated with that. It is unbelievably brutal. And I would always find myself going into these instances and circumstances, you know, with maybe $100 in my checking account. And I'm just blown. I'm broke immediately right on campus within the first week, just because of those honestly somewhat hidden fees that you're not really, you know, especially as a freshman, I'm too cognizant about. And additionally, in terms of, yeah, applying to colleges is, you know, I think like $75 an application. But what's even more so is you have to send, at least when I was applying to colleges, you have to even spend money just to send your SAT scores in certain locations. And so I know that's something that has been talked about at ABTS generally, at least during, you know, my administration, in terms of like, how can we make this application process, at least the application process, better and more equitable. However, I, again, proud retiree of student government.
Rodrigo, is there anything you'd like to add?
Yes. So in terms of the advocacy that's going around on in terms of fees, I know that a lot of the efforts that have been put into that at the University of Minnesota sort of focus on the other end of that equation, fees that come up after you become a student, which in fact make up a significant portion. I think almost one out of every $5 that a student pays goes towards fees of some sort, more so than it does to tuition. But on the other end of that, I think that there are some initiatives that are already in place that are a move in the correct direction at the very least. So for example, I know that many colleges in the state of Minnesota, and I don't know if this applies to other states necessarily, but many colleges will waive their fees during the month of October, or at least for a week during the month of October, because I think it's like College Knowledge Month or something like that. And so, you know, that is, of course, a way to remove those barriers. But of course, the problem then becomes that that is very early in the application cycle. And so for students who maybe don't have the resources to be, who are ready to apply during that month, that can be an additional challenge as well.
So here at Purdue, something that our president is very proud of, we've been a tuition freeze for around 7 years now. And I know that they're hoping to make it to 10. It is a huge feat, but we know that it affects in terms of the quality of our facilities on campus, as well as our staff and faculty, that you sometimes don't have access to the same resources in the classroom because of a freeze in tuition. And so I was curious to hear your opinions on tuition freezes, how your university is tackling that, and what effects it might have on the quality of education that you receive.
So the University of Michigan, the Board of Trustees voted to actually increase the tuition cost during the summer leading into this school year. You know, the exact amount I'm unaware of, but just even the fact that it was raised at all is deeply troubling to me. And the response from the administration was, we were going to raise it anyways at this point, so we just continued on with that plan, which, considering the global pandemic and the inequities that it's only exacerbated, to me, that's just almost criminal. So as of right now, in terms of how the administration is thinking to proceed with tuition freezes or, you know, lack thereof, I'm unsure, because we do have an administration that is helpful at times, but can also be not transparent at times as well. So all I know is that it was just people's heads were exploding on campus when we heard that news. And then additionally, put yourself in the shoes of a low-income student on campus, or even a middle-class student on campus, because I know that for the people who are, you know, low-income on student, very thankfully, they have Pell Grants, and we have the Go Blue Guarantee, which is anybody making under $65,000 a year automatically has their tuition covered, and anybody above that within a certain range has, you know, a majority or a certain amount of it covered. So really, the people who are hurt the most from these tuition hikes are, you know, the middle class. And so everybody was just, you know, sort of devastated and was really looking for solutions, and of which, besides, you know, those protests and those advocacy groups, there's not a whole lot you can do just because it's seven people in a boardroom with a closed door who are making all of these decisions on behalf of tens of thousands of students.
Yeah, I think, you know, the situation is similar in many ways at the University of Minnesota. It differs markedly in that the Board of Regents did decide to freeze tuition at the end of last year in light of the fact that there was this pandemic that was going to disrupt, you know, pretty much the whole world for the foreseeable future. And I think that was a very wise decision on their part. But of course, that only does so much. You know, freezing the tuition at an unaffordable rate doesn't really do anything to address the underlying problems. But that being said, of course, students were very grateful for that because obviously it sort of takes off some financial pressure, and especially that's the case for non-resident, non-reciprocity students whose tuition sometimes increases at more than twice the rate of students who are residents of Minnesota who do receive reciprocity. And so I don't know, quite frankly, whether the tuition freeze that was put in place last year will continue, but it's certainly my hope that the Board of Regents will consider it. And when and if they do, I will be in the room pushing them as hard as I can to keep it in place and see what other financial measures there are so that we can also keep the university in a financially secure position as well.
Rodrigo, you bring up a great point about non-domestic students. And so that's another a downside to our tuition freeze, right, is that it's freezing for Indiana residents as well as domestic students. But for our international population, we've seen a significant rise, which affects our international students. And here at Purdue, it's around 22% of our student body, which is a large percentage. And so are you aware? And Another component to be an international student, they don't have access to federal funding and are very limited in terms of scholarship options. Do your universities offer programs for international students to help with funding?
I know that, speaking very generally, that the opportunities for scholarship and just opportunities in general for international students in terms at the University of Michigan are quite limited. I know that, you know, there's even such barriers like applying to the University of Michigan because there, you know, there's visa restrictions, there's this and that, you know, particularly lately with our current federal administration, it's not easy to get anywhere in this, you know, to go to college as an international student. However, at the University of Michigan, nothing special that I'm at least aware of. And I feel like if I, as somebody who was particularly involved during my college career, I'm unsure of that question. I feel like the people who are literally coming from out of the country to a new school likely would not either. So it's very, very challenging in that sense.
Yeah, I would say, first of all, that I don't think I'm sufficiently informed as to know what specific programs are in place here, specifically for non-resident, non-reciprocity students. But you're absolutely right. It is a challenging process coming from abroad or generally abroad, yes. And the cost is sort of ridiculous. It's very high, there's no doubt. But at the same time, I think it reflects sort of this underlying reality that is, you know, over the past several years and possibly decades now, we've seen consistently less investment in higher education from state legislatures than we had. And so that is part of what ends up contributing to this problem in the long run.
So moving into once students are on campus, there's often a trade-off professionally and academically when you are low income, first generation student that has to work all the time to afford, whether that be housing or tuition, and then you miss out on things like student government or extracurricular activities or going to the pre-career fair so that you can get an internship. What is the responsibility, not just of the student government, but really any student organization, honor societies that you maybe on paper, a student doesn't look like they're actively involved, but they're trying to keep up their finances and are putting in significant work. What is our responsibility to ensure that they have a comprehensive college experience, that they aren't left out when it comes to recruitment opportunities and being flexible to ensure that they're involved in the community?
And this is a huge one for me because this is something that was always particularly irksome to me and some of my peers at the University of Michigan. So I made the decision personally very early on that student government was my focus and was something I felt that I needed to do and I was drawn to it. And obviously it's a very, very taxing, time-intensive job as you all know. And with at that point, I couldn't get a job. And I sort of realized my freshman year, a job was out of the equation. which meant that over the summer, each and every like dollar that I earned, I had to save, which, you know, I'd start the school year with a little nest egg of sometimes like $500, which nest egg of $500, but it was the best I could do. And I sort of had to make that stretch for literally as long as possible. Towards the end of the semester, it was just all calf food and, you know, it's certainly no visits home because I didn't have, you know, the means to even get home for the most part. And so I feel that there's a massive responsibility to aid students like me. And I think that very tangibly within the realm of student government, at the University of Michigan, no position whatsoever is paid. You have students like Michigan State University to where their executive team is paid. So that enables people to do both. They can work and they can also, you know, serve the school in that way through student government. Which I think that we should all be a huge proponent for. I even, if there was the budget for it, I would even like to see General Assembly members get paid for, you know, their time each week. But I understand that for some, that may not be the case. I also think that with all of this said, there needs to be just flat out more conversations about this. This is something that I feel that I see once or twice a semester saying, this is not right. And then sort of the talk stops there. There needs to be so much more than that. There needs to be concrete, you know, advocacy and legislation, and sort of not just have the conversation follow the trends of the time.
Yeah, I think there's obviously a variety of factors that go into the challenges that face, for example, first gen and low income students. You know, the University of Minnesota is not immune to them in any way. And so one of the issues that we've been fighting for over the past several years has been raising our campus minimum wage. Because the University of Minnesota is governed by the state legislature and not subject to the rules and regulations of the city of Minneapolis or St. Paul, that means that the minimum wage on campus is actually substantially less than that in Minneapolis, at least, which is the one I'm more familiar with. Minneapolis recently passed an ordinance that would make the minimum wage $15 for larger employers within the next 5 years, as I understand it. But that, of course, doesn't apply to the University of Minnesota. And so, you know, we've been pushing the Board of Regents on this for several months, if not years at this point, because, you know, it is a challenge and students need to be able to have funding for their own education. And in many cases that comes from working these higher wage jobs on campus than they might have back home. For a student like me, I live in rural Minnesota. The minimum wage here is, you know, the minimum wage of the state, and it's highly unlikely that I would be able to find a job if I wanted one that was, that could pay me $15 an hour here. I think another important part of this too, though, is sort of looking at the protections that exist for students, regardless of how they're contributing to their university. So as you were saying, Aiden, you know, making sure that student government leaders are paid. I'm very proud of the fact that the University of Minnesota does do that on some level, but at the same time, the compensation that some students do receive for their time in student government. And I can say this, I can attest to this personally, because I've seen the hard work that so many of our students put in, is in no way, the money they receive is in no way comparable to the work that they do. The tireless advocacy that they put in, hours and hours every week. But, you know, it's a step in the right direction, at least. But, you know, in my own experience, what that has meant is, for example, last year, when I was in my first year as a student representative to the Board of Regents, the most significant sort of part that I had in writing our report to the Board of Regents that year was about student research protections. And that is because, you know, at the University of Minnesota, there wasn't and still isn't a centralized way to see which students are doing research with which professors. And so it creates all sort of accountability nightmares, as you can imagine. But, you know, on the other side of this coin too, is we don't know how students are being compensated for the intellectual work that they're doing. In many cases, or even whether the work that they're doing in terms of research is something that is going to lead to gainful employment outcomes or is going to, you know, develop them professionally in that sense too. So that is making sure that students have the ability to either make money or have their research experiences reflected on their transcripts, for example. These are all part of making sure that students have the skills they need when they graduate to find a job that is in line with what they would like to do. And then the last thing I would say is that I know that there are certain scholarships here that allow students, or that are designed specifically for students, to be able to take sort of lower paying jobs during the summer, and to sort of offset the cost of that. Because I know that, you know, for a student that doesn't have the income to just, you know, choose a job that they like as opposed to a job that they need, it can be very challenging. And this is especially true with the proliferation of unpaid internships and those sorts of, in my opinion, problematic programs. And so those scholarships are designed really to supplement the income that students make, so that a student, you know, if they have to make the choice between a job that pays $20 an hour and a job that pays $17.50, they don't have to necessarily compromise their own personal desire to work at the lower paid job purely for the sake of money. And so I think these are all, of course, relatively minor tweaks to a larger system that we, of course, need to evaluate very carefully. But I'm very proud of that, for sure.
As you should be. That is an incredible program. I've been taking notes this whole time, but I'm so excited to share that. I also, hitting on student governance and specifically having their members be paid, I personally believe that student leaders across, we call them sort of legacy organizations, but even like our BSU or Black Student Union or African Student Association or smaller orgs, I feel like play such a big part in the campus culture. And oftentimes our administration will call on various organizations to be there and do things on their behalf. And then they're left high and dry financially to fund for themselves. And so I think that all student org presidents and exec boards should be on payroll just because of the amount of work that they're doing for the student body. And so I'm glad that we all share similar views. And I think that that is something shared across the Big Ten. So just wanted to discuss a little bit. So we're going to kind of move into a space of COVID. We know it's impacted every aspect of our life, but in terms of college affordability, has taken it to a whole another level. And I guess we'll start with CARES funding, because as of August 2019, Purdue had given away the lowest amount of CARES funding out of all of the Big Ten. We're about 12%. Whereas our Big Ten peers, 12%. Whereas our Big Ten peers were around 75%, 90%. So are you aware of any discrepancies in terms of how your university was giving out CARES funding? What's happening now? And maybe walk us through the process a little bit, as well as how that money was given out.
So at the University of Michigan, very thankfully, it was publicized rather well, in my opinion. We were sent multiple emails from the university. At least in my case, a lot of my professors even said, hey, students, CARES Act, here's how to apply for it. I think there needed to be more of an emphasis on demystifying the process of applying for the CARES Act. I know a lot of friends of mine who still, despite those emails, did not even know where to begin. There's a misconception of perhaps that they would have to pay back the sum at some point. Like what the funds specifically could be used for. Furthermore, I think like with the CARES Act, again, like it was great that there was such a push at the University of Michigan, but I know that at a state level, even just using Michigan as an example, some of these smaller colleges, they either did not share the fact that CARES Act was something that was happening, very intentionally so, I believe, or again, there was just not the push there. And so that's something I think the University of Michigan did well, but it's something that still sort of troubles me in terms of like the fact that like just across our state, it was not disseminated nearly as well. That's all I'll say for now.
Yeah, so, in terms of CARES Act allocation at the University of Minnesota, I am not entirely familiar with the exact amount that has been given out, but I do know that at the last Board of Regents meeting that I can recall where this was discussed, I believe the University of Minnesota had given out more than 94% of our CARES Act funding. And I think two of our campuses had given out 100% of the CARES Act funding that had been allocated for them. So I'm very happy about that. And you know, the University of Minnesota is very proud to have the highest voter turnout rate of the Big Ten. So I like to think that our students are, you know, sort of not just politically engaged, but also pay attention to these large sort of national developments such as CARES Act funding. So it wasn't really a surprise to me then to see that the university student body was very engaged in that process. And I think similar to what Aiden mentioned, we had many communications, both through official channels and through informal channels, telling students that this money was there, and you know, it didn't take any effort at all, basically, to apply. It was, I know for me, the way I came to see it in my inbox was an all-campus email sent directly from the president's office. And I think, quite frankly, the only way they could have gotten my attention more was if they had put free money in the subject line. They made it very clear that this was going to be an easy process. There was a link in the email that you could just click on, and it would automatically take you to the page where you could put in the information. It also provided some context on the page about how that money, you know, that it wasn't just free money, that it, you know, had come from the federal government. So there was some sort of background there too. But then, you know, I think we can always do more to sort of engage students in that process. And one of the ways that this manifests is that due to, and this is, you know, more on the part of the federal government than it is on the part of the University of Minnesota, due to the regulations that were imposed with the CARES Act funding, as, you know, we actually couldn't provide those funds to undocumented students, which is of course a huge problem because so many DACA recipients or Dreamers are, you know, integral parts of our campus communities. And so that was really, it was an unjust decision at the federal level, but it was something that I think we worked on here as much as we could until, as I understand it, that regulation was either perhaps relaxed or rescinded. But I think some of that money did end up being allocated to those students eventually.
Yeah, and additionally, furthermore, so at the University of Michigan, there was like a formal application process. I do unfortunately know people who applied for the CARES Act and were not approved in the slightest. I know that I applied for it, and I, this, which is understandable, I did not receive all of the funds that I requested, which is understandable knowing the limitations of, you know, that pot of money. But I know more students than not who were denied funding altogether, and of which the specifics and what goes on behind the scenes, I'm not aware of. But I know that there was a formal application process and it was not enough to just say, I need aid and I need it quickly.
Absolutely. And speaking for students who weren't able to get CARES Act funding, I know a lot of universities and student government associations, not just within the Big Ten, but across the country, put in place emergency COVID aid funds. I know specifically at Rutgers, that was a huge feat. University of Iowa, and that was what we used in the spring to sort of model our COVID funding for students. Were universities able to do anything like that to supplement aid that students weren't able to receive, maybe from CARES funding or from other organizations?
Sure. So at the University of Minnesota, I know that we did put in place a program specifically. I'm struggling to recall the name of the program, but we did have a student emergency fund that any student can apply for. My understanding is that the award, as much as we can call it that, or the funds generally are less than $1,000. And I personally am not aware of anyone that has requested that funding, but I do know that it exists. I unfortunately can't tell you how easy or difficult it is to apply, but it is there and it's an important resource for students, certainly. I think in addition to that, you know, the Minnesota Student Association, which is our student government at the Twin Cities campus, was also very committed to sort of moving whatever funds we had personally in the direction that would help students. So one of the things that we did was take the funding that we had that was, you know, not gonna be spent. So for example, travel expenses, that simply was not gonna be spent after lockdown in March. That money was then reallocated by a vote of our forum body to our Nutritious You food pantry, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's a food pantry for students who suffer from food insecurity or who, you know, simply need a place to go to find food. And so by doing that, we also provided support for our own campus community, which is something that I am super proud of and that I think, you know, if possible, should be replicated elsewhere as needed.
Yeah, at the University of Michigan, we had a very similar fund. I'm unsure of the cap. Off the top of my head, I want to say around $1,500 in terms of that extra support that you could apply for. But we have a pre-existing food pantry that came about previous to this that is unbelievable. Any student can go in and get, you know, fresh groceries. We're talking like fresh fruits, like a whole head of lettuce, like amazing, amazing opportunities. And it's so normal. It's normalized there in terms of accessibility and affordability, because not just the poor kids, quote unquote, go in there. Everybody uses it. It's a community resource to where everybody can use, and it is huge on campus. I'm unsure of how the funding works for it and things like that, but during the time frame of which it's open, any student can go in with a valid M card, and that has definitely helped during the COVID, you know, pandemic, and has really helped, you know, aid some inequities.
So moving on to our kind of winding it down. Actually, I'm just kidding. Another aspect that was really important to talk about, and University of Maryland kind of spearheaded this effort, was that when the shutdown happened, a lot of off-campus housing weren't letting students off of their contracts. And for universities like Minnesota, who I know went online, you're stuck in these housing contracts. And so now you have to pay for spaces that you can't use, especially if you're going home. And so at University of Maryland, I know they were working together with the city to try and get some spaces to let students out of their leases. Is there anything your universities are trying to do to help with this relationship? I know here it's a constant struggle. But we'd love to hear your perspective and if there are any initiatives.
So and I can even quickly circle back to, so for the dorms at the University of Michigan, which I know is different than the outside housing, no questions asked. You can just get your money refunded back to you. And if you are on Pell Grant or some sort of scholarship, et cetera, you can actually get that money refunded back to you as well. So that's been a nice sort of lump sum for, you know, people who are receiving these scholarships to fall back on during COVID, which has been great. In terms of the relationship with the city, I'm unaware of any like specific initiatives going on between the administration and the city. However, I can say that the city and our administration has been extremely communicative and transparent about their conversations. I'm pretty sure even some sort of log is posted somewhere about that. Additionally, I know that generally the consensus in Ann Arbor is that the landlords are somewhat unwilling to make negotiations. However, I would say that there's a new social push. I can't say legislative push, but social push, thanks to some, you know, student advocates, that they are, of course, more understanding, allowed the students to break out of contracts if need be, especially after the University of Michigan officially called for students to go home for the remainder of this semester and next semester, which was really game changing in terms of that, you know, landlord relationship.
Yeah, I will say that at the University of Minnesota, I am not aware of any specifically university-related pushes around sort of off-campus housing and, you know, the contracts there. But I do know that the University of Minnesota has a very strong branch of student legal services, which provides free, or as I understand, I think it's almost always free, legal representation to students of the university that pay a student service fee. And so that's invaluable. I know I personally have used them on multiple occasions to go in and like have my contract reviewed before I even signed. But on the flip side of that, you know, it's, you know, due to the legally binding nature of those documents, I think it has been really tough for some students at the University of Minnesota. I know that many students have taken to subleasing whatever apartments they had instead, which I think you know, is a great idea on many of their parts, especially if they're not gonna come back to the city. But at the same time, I recognize that that means that there's sort of a buyer's market, if you will. So at that point, students are sort of trying to figure out what the lowest price is. And so, it, you know, students are not getting the housing that they were going to get on campus if they're subleasing, but they're also not making up the rent that they would have been paying anyway. So there, it speaks to sort of a structural problem there. But that being said, I really do think that students have, in many cases, sort of seen the writing on the wall and have made the financial decision that they think is best for them moving forward. And, you know, in that sense, have either decided to put off signing a lease for next semester, next year. I know that is the situation of many students, or have instead decided to completely just not tutor, which, you know, I suppose we'll have to see how that goes, but I feel very positively about the developments there.
Here at Purdue, there were, when a lot of budget cuts were made due to finances lost both last semester and moving into this semester. And so particularly one department, the Department of Interdisciplinary Studies, which includes gender studies, women's studies, African-American studies, took a big hit. And it was going to be a huge loss to our community. But thankfully, for this year, our provost pledged to refund the money that was going to be taken away from that department, just to uplift our commitment as a university to diversity, equity, inclusion, and the importance of having that department. But at your respective universities, have there been cuts in any substantial fashion that have affected students' lives?
Well, I think, you know, most, if not all, cuts that the university puts in place, of course, have an impact on students' lives. There's no doubt about that. But, you know, some of the cuts that were made, I personally think make sense in the time of a pandemic. So, for example, Go for Chauffeur, which provided a service for it was, you know, effectively a free Uber ride from neighborhoods near campus for students who maybe didn't want to walk home at night. I think, you know, as much as I think that service is really useful and, of course, something that we should have, it becomes dangerous during a pandemic like the one we have to put students in, you know, these closed vehicles with no sort of airflow or ventilation, with student workers for that matter. So I think that was a prudent decision, although I'm looking forward, hopefully, to the day when that program is reinstated. But that being said, in terms of university departments overall, there were cuts, of course, but I am not aware of any that sort of had like direct impacts on students from the very inception. I will say that admin has been very committed to making sure that the weight is distributed, the burden is borne, you know, at least somewhat in a distributed fashion. There have been furloughs. There has definitely been the cancellation of scheduled raises, for example. And in addition, I know that President Gable at the University of Minnesota and several high-level members of the administration have also taken voluntary pay cuts in order to sort of protect the financial situation of the university. But of course, when we're talking about a budget in the millions of dollars, that sort of effort, while noble, certainly in the long run, it sort of doesn't do as much as I would like.
Last COVID-related question, and then we'll kind of wind it down, but we've noticed that our students are both that have decided to stay home this semester and that are here have an increased cost with technology in terms of utilities because they're at home more often. Food, just like you had alluded to earlier, Aiden, about staying home and things being closed. And so trying to find ways that we can help students have access. Is there anything that your university is doing to provide? I know that a few across the nation have like electronic fees. So if you had to buy a new computer because you typically would use one on campus and you don't have access, they're making stipulations in that regard. Is there anything like that happening on your campus?
Yeah, so I know that as soon as we were sent home a bit ago, we had a partnership with Adobe. So all students at the University of Michigan can use Adobe products for free with a valid Michigan email. Furthermore, as well as that, in terms of like offsetting costs, I know that professors, and this is a social thing, there's no mandate for this, have been cutting back on what textbooks are or are not needed. And some have even volunteered, like, hey, I know this is, you know, unprecedented times, and we'll actually pay or loan you that source. Following the number of resources closing on campus in terms of the library and access to hotspots and Wi-Fi, things like that, there has been talk to essentially make it so that students could possibly out of their financial aid package take out like a subsidy for their Wi-Fi at home. And so there's been numerous conversations, there's been numerous things recently for seniors as well. You can have free cap and gown rentals despite our graduation possibly and probably being virtual. In terms of, although this is not financially, you know, relevant, in terms of socially and for students' mental health, we have recently moved to a pass-fail model as well as at Michigan State University. So there are a number of accommodations being had here, both financially and socially. And for me personally, it's meant the world, like having those accommodations, knowing that, you know, having the added stresses of being at home or even just having the added stresses of the finances that we've spoken of, the additional financial burden, of course, could cause your mental health or your grades or a combination of both to slip in some way. And sort of to even have any sort of leeway, I've found to be very helpful.
So now moving out of college, you're transitioning into the real world, as they say. Some folks are lucky enough to graduate with zero debt. They've had various opportunities to get to that moment, but others are graduating with some debt or even to a significant amount of debt and then have to go and start their lives. And it can be a daunting task, extremely overwhelming. And so what is the obligation of our universities, of our federal government to ensure that we are in a space where we can be supported and that we can go and take what we went to college for, our education, and make something of ourselves without having this fear of what is to come in terms of debt. Rodrigo, do you want to start?
Yeah, thank you. It's a great question. There is certainly a lot of progress that needs to be made. You know, I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but the situation regarding student loans is not only ridiculous, it's quite frankly untenable. It's ridiculous to expect that students who are fresh out of college, as you say, entering the real world, are going to be like economically successful in their first few years if they have these crushing amounts of debt. You know, there are some silver linings, I suppose, in that average indebtedness, at least at the University of Minnesota, is slightly down over the past 5 years. However, you know, the federal government really does have an obligation to make sure that students are not simply working to pay off these loans and are instead working to save this money and, you know, perhaps buy a house or invest in a car, do all these things that are good for the economy in the long term and at a larger scale. And so for that reason, I personally think that the federal government has an obligation to cancel student debt. And it's very encouraging to me that there are some signs that the incoming Biden administration is looking into doing that. I think there are some proposals floating around of canceling about $50,000 worth of student debt per person. And that's a good first step. But, you know, since this is, of course, executive action that can be done at the stroke of the president-elect's pen, I think it would be a good idea for him to consider doing all of it, especially since it also seems that, well, it doesn't seem, it is the case that students missed out on the first round of the stimulus check. So they didn't have this economic boost that others did. There is nothing that would provide a greater economic boost instantly in people's lives than canceling this truly astounding amount of student debt. Moving beyond the student debt issue, which I think you might be able to tell I feel very passionately about, there also needs to be a reconfiguration at the state level, which is where much of this funding comes from, about what the purpose is of our public universities. You know, our public universities have long been the center of research and innovation in the United States. And so it's critical to make sure that we are hiring the best possible professors and giving them the incentives that they need to stay at our universities. And so over the past several years, we've seen an increase in the use of adjunct professors who routinely have fewer jobs protections and also are compensated less than tenure track professors. And that's in large part because state budgets, which have neglected higher education for a long time, have made it so that it is more financially sustainable in the long run to do that. But, you know, this means that the professors that students are having are oftentimes facing financial difficulties of their own. And so, you know, this is unacceptable. At the University of Minnesota, or at any publicly funded university for that matter, no professor should have to be in that sort of situation, especially if they're doing the work of teaching the next generation, and in some cases, perhaps also conducting research. And so I would really like to see an increase in funding from state legislatures. You know, in 1989, almost 40% of University of Minnesota funding came from the state legislature. And in 2014, that number had fallen to just 18%. And so we've really seen this huge inversion where state legislators are investing less while students in turn are having to pick up the slack and pay ever increasing costs in tuition.
Well, thank you so much, Rodrigo. That was an incredible answer, and I share your passion in terms of eliminating student debt. So hoping that this administration makes it happen. Thank you all so much for participating. It has been an absolute pleasure going through all the aspects of college affordability, starting from before you get there and until when you leave. And so it's been a journey. And I know we could talk about this all night, but want to be very respectful of your time.
Yeah, so thank you all for taking time out of your very busy schedules to share your thoughts and experiences with us. It's students like you and conversations like this that remind us and empower us to keep advocating, keep organizing, and keep applying pressure. With that being said, be well, and we can't wait to see you all again between class.